Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And we are at the interview part of the show. Today we are talking about Hitler. And in reference to a book called Hitler's Suicide, Reasonable Doubt. And on the line we have the author of this book, and we'll talk about the book and the subject. So, Peter David Orr, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's start out. First of all, so the audience gets an idea, where do you come from and how do you get into writing about Hitler?
That's a great question. I'll take you back to the year 2011. And at that time, I was in contact with a person that you may be familiar with. Your audience may know the name from the book Grey Wolf, Gerard Williams. And we were working together, but not in a way that, of course, people might assume. I was actually in communication with him because I was intent on debunking Grey Wolf. And I was doing it in a friendly way. I was not attacking him. You know, in as a historian, my attitude is, you know, it's not to make him look bad or anyone to look good. It's just to find the truth. And at the time, I was absolutely convinced, as are most people, that the standard account of Hitler's suicide in the bunker on April 30th, 1945 was as is, you know, the standard account. I believed it and didn't see any reason to doubt it. And I read the book Grey Wolf just out of curiosity. And I reached out to him and I was stunned that he actually was willing to go back and forth with me. So what happened in the process of discussing the book with him, and I was... And my attitude was, you know, Gerard, there are parts of this book that just must be fixed. This can't be true and this can't be true. But what happened in the process is I was sort of hooked in the process of trying to debunk things that he was saying in the book. But what I was discovering were there other connections that weren't necessarily made in the book that were very intriguing, that actually were making the argument for him. And, you know, once you go down that avenue, it becomes very interesting because here I was trying to debunk the book and finding things that were actually in support of his arguments and sharing them with him. And to make a long story short there, you can imagine the day that I realized that I was in myself at a tipping point where what he was saying may not be completely accurate in Grey Wolf, but I was finding enough evidence, enough contradictory testimony among those who had supposedly witnessed Hitler's suicide, the burning of his body and destruction of his body, etc., that I had reasonable doubt at that point about the standard account. So at that point...
Peter.
Yes.
I have a question. Did you already speak to Aubrey Temples about before you spoke to Gerard Williams?
My association with Gerard began in 2011, but in late 2016, Gerard sent a message to me after our latest back and forth saying, look, I don't want to deal with such and such a person anymore. They keep contacting me to tell me their story, and you handle this. So who are you talking about, Gerard? And Gerard gave me the contact information, said, well, there's this fellow by the name of Lewis Robinson III, and his father-in-law, a man by the name of Aubrey Temples, he has an interesting story, but it doesn't really fit into Grey Wolf, and I'm tired of dealing with it. So he asked me if I would deal with it. When I heard the story as told to me by Gerard, my initial impression was, okay, this doesn't fit in with anything that we know about the possibility that Hitler escaped. So I was completely skeptical. And I know I'm dealing with a 90-some-year-old fellow at this point. So I called up his son-in-law and said, okay, I'm willing to do interviews with Aubrey, but you have to understand that I'm gonna push him pretty hard. And Lewis Robinson, his son-in-law, said, well, believe it or not, he's quite sharp for, you know, a guy who's 91 years old. So do what you can. See, he might surprise you how much he can actually remember and you know, how flexible he is with his memory. So I called the fella, and after about 10 minutes, I was flabbergasted. I was completely hooked on Aubrey's story in the sense of, well, you know, you hear details down the line from somebody else telling you, and then you hear the person tell you their own story, and there are always hooks in there that you hadn't heard before, and so you can imagine those 10 minutes turned into 40 minutes and an hour in our first interview. And I pushed him really hard, and I said, Aubrey, I don't believe your story, and I don't mean to offend you, but let's talk about each detail. And do you have the patience to talk about each detail? Because if this doesn't hold up, well, then your story cannot be true. If this doesn't hold up, then your story cannot be true. And we went at it in sessions like that, seven in a row over a period of six and a half months.
So you were straight up with him.
Oh my goodness, yes. And I, you know, here this guy is a legit war hero first, so I had to have some level of respect for the guy, even if I suspected that he was, you know, a little kooky. Now it turned out that he's not a conspiracy theorist. He's not kooky in any way, shape, or form. He's just a salt of the earth, unpretentious. Genuine. He didn't get flabbergasted with my continual cross examinations of his story. And again, what happened is as I pushed him, I found, you know, there were parts of his story that didn't make sense. But then when I would research it, that's what he meant. You know, it is true that Aubrey's memory, we're dealing with a 90, 91, 92-year-old fellow, as I'm speaking with him, his memory is pretty darn good. But anybody, after all that time, their memory's not going to be perfect. Now, what he had going for him was that over the years, you know, he'd been thinking about this, and he had been treated pretty shabbily by other people that he had told. I mean, he even had an opportunity to talk to Judge Davidson and that was federal district court judge of Texas back in the day in 1963, 1968. They were friends at that time. And the judge was equally fascinated by the story as I was. So it's not as if Aubrey hasn't been telling his story. He had been telling his stories from the very beginning. So when he was, for instance, liberated, you know, he was a prisoner of war. And when Aubrey was liberated, he was telling the story, or trying to tell the story to the very first people that he saw. And he wrote a very detailed letter, you know, as a young soldier, he really believed that he might get this passed up the chain to Eisenhower, and that's what he tried to do. And so the very first person that he met, when he was liberated from a very unusual small work camp in southern Bavaria, he wrote a detailed account of exactly what he'd seen, what he had witnessed. So anyway, I keep going on and on about this, but the bottom line is that as I tried to debunk his story, I found, similar with what I had experienced with Gerard, more and more things that actually added up and less things that I could actually debunk. So I do believe, I am convinced, and it's not a matter of faith, it's a matter of, does the evidence show me, does what Aubrey said add up? Did he see Hitler in a little village in southern Bavaria called Neustorf am Inn? I believe he did. And I believe Hitler was on his way from Neustorf the morning that he saw him, on his way to Innsbruck, Austria, and then on to Spain from there.
And Spain, is Argentina involved, or is it Spain is where?
Well, I believe, again, I'm not going to back this up with any evidence, because this is one of the subjects I have purposely not tackled. I believe from Spanish territory, he then went on to Argentina and perhaps other places. But I must admit that my level of expertise and research in that particular realm is insufficient. And so I don't feel comfortable making any proclamations or with any level of confidence other than I believe that he escaped and made it to South America.
We've had Gerard on. I think I've had him on three times. I've known him a few years. He's a nice guy. He's done a lot of research as far as the Argentina and that area. I just wonder, in general, so why is there such a bite back to this whole idea that Hitler escaped? Like, because as soon as, what I mean is, as soon as you say that, or as soon as you have anybody writes any book toward this field, or gets into the idea that Hitler didn't die in the bunker, they're labeled in a negative way as a conspiracy theorist or something like that. But why is there such a bite back? Like, why do people feel that way automatically?
It depends on the person. And my dealings with people that are like you describe, they come at that from all different angles, actually. I've encountered probably, 10 to 12 different distinct groups that have an objection, a visceral objection, if you will, to the entire notion. There are people who I would describe as secret admirers, people who wouldn't come out in public and say they think that Hitler was pretty cool, this, that, and the other thing. But one of the things that they have in common, those secret admirers, is that they have a faith that Hitler was sick, very sick, not able to go out in the streets of Berlin and fight as he wanted to. You know, they believe that Hitler wanted to go out and die fighting Bolshevism, if you will, but that he couldn't because of just how ill he was. And among those who actually respect Hitler, they respect that he committed, he stayed to the very end and committed suicide, instead of allowing himself to be captured by the Soviets. And so that makes him, in their eyes, a hero. So if I say something like, he escaped, those people who regard Hitler as doing something heroic by staying there to the very end, they're very offended, and they hate me. They just, there's no other way to describe it. Or anybody else who might dare to say that, they're going to object.
Not so romantic. There's another,
yeah, they are romantics in that sense. And you're not going to change their mind because it's an ideology. It's a part of the fabric of what they are, who they are, what they stand for. Are they Nazis, neo-Nazis? They might not admit it, but it's probably accurate. Now, there are a whole bunch of people that object for, how can I say this in general? They think that I'm profiteering off of quote-unquote dumb people. So if you say something that goes against the grain of whatever's established history, automatically the label comes out, you're just greedy. you're bought and sold, or you're a profiteer, or you're taking advantage of uninformed people. How dare you? That kind of attitude. So any retelling of the standard narrative, even for the sake of comparison and like asking a question, you'll automatically get that reaction from those who approach the idea that Hitler escaped or didn't die in Berlin, for that reason. Of course, my take on this is I can forgive them because there's a certain truth to the fact that people do get taken advantage of in the world of writing and journalism and history. I mean, fake news is real. To people, I mean, and do people sometimes get taken advantage of by this? That's very true, but it's not my motive. My motive is not to make money, and I'd like to turn this around on people if they're willing to listen and say, let's think for a moment about how much money was made on the story that is accepted. Whether it's Hugh Trevor Roper's, multiple editions of his Hitler's Last Days, the guy made millions. And it's not just him. It's all of the, the quote-unquote bunker witnesses who told, supposedly their story. It turns out not to be really their story, but just a repeated, regurgitated story that somebody else told them to tell. They made, each of these, bunker witnesses, they made lots of money, too, in films and you name it. So, okay. So, is there profit to be made off of selling books? If you object to the idea that somebody might make profit by selling a book, well, hey, that's your belief. I don't see personally anything wrong with a person making money off of something they've worked hard on. In this case, for instance, for the book Hitler's Suicide, Reasonable Doubt, that's 10 years of research for me. What can I say to people except it's a long, hard slog and many, 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 many hours beyond that I could even count. So,
I was going to say, so when you talk about the witnesses, how were they, how do I put this? So the witnesses to the bunker and his death and all that stuff, are you saying that they didn't tell the truth or what can you tell? Okay, well, maybe explain that. How about that?
Yeah, this is an involved answer, so I hope your audience will forgive me. But memory is an interesting thing. Experiencing something as traumatic as the Battle of Berlin in itself plays havoc with the mind. Being in the bunker with Hitler adds another level to that. Being someone who was lock, stock, and barrel devoted to this man puts another level on top of that. So every time that we think about what they say, we have to put it in context. And we also have to put it in context of what everyone else said. I'll just give you a brief statistic. When I go through all of the eyewitness testimony, including the hearsay eyewitness testimony, and those who sold, you know, direct things either about an association with Hitler in the bunker or some direct aspect of his death or his burning or burial, you know, include all those things in that discussion, what you find is about 75% of everything said is just provably wrong in one way or another. So now, on the surface, that looks like it's a slam dunk, but it's not. And the reason it's not is because, truthfully, most people who witness some sort of a crime, their memory isn't all that accurate either. So keep that in mind. So I'm not saying that just because 75% of what the eyewitnesses say is incorrect and provably wrong, that automatically they must be lying. What I'm saying is there's a lot of inaccuracy there that is just human nature to begin with. So that's the first level to this. The second level is that when you start analyzing, it's roughly 80 witnesses that you could dig into in any depth. What you discover is that, you know, 65, 66 of them are hearsay witnesses exclusively. They're treated in many history books that repeat the standard account as if they were eyewitnesses, but they weren't actually eyewitnesses. They were told something by somebody else, and they passed on in a very convincing way. So you have to wade through all of those people and find out exactly what did they actually see and where did this information come from. And once you wade through all of those hearsay witnesses, what you discover is you can boil it down to two people. 65, 66 people can be boiled down to two. So their testimony, in other words, rests upon the word of two men who were present throughout the entire process of Hitler's suicide, burning, and burial. And perhaps you've heard the name Otto Gunsche and Heinz Linge. So Heinz Linge was Hitler's valet, and Otto Gunsche was Hitler's number one personal adjutant, his number one personal aide. And so what you have to do next is you have to then look at each of those individuals who have made statements affirming they were eyewitnesses, direct eyewitnesses to any part of it, and you have to apply the same standard you do with the hearsay witnesses, and you have to break them down to see if they have certain things in common, if they have certain stories in common, and they all do. And again, what's remarkable is it all boils down to those same two men once again. So just to make a long story short, I mean, I could go on and on about individual witnesses if you want me to, but I'll just give you one example of how fragile all that, what seems like a mountain of testimony, actually is. So if you take Gunsche and Linge, both of these individuals were captured by the Soviets following the Battle of Berlin, and they ended up in Soviet prison, and they were interrogated. And they were interrogated endlessly. Number one, their stories morphed. So the stories they told to begin with when they were captured were one thing, and then they became B, C, D, E, F, and through the 9 and 10 years that they were in Soviet captivity, when they were the individuals that were used by the Soviets to craft a story for Stalin himself, what you find is that they were mystified. The interrogators, the Soviets themselves, were, oh my, what are we going to do with this? Because there's so many inconsistencies, and we have to iron them out, and we have to give Stalin something. So they were under a tremendous amount of pressure in the first year or two to craft a narrative that Stalin would accept. And you can imagine the kind of fear that those who were in Soviet intelligence, what kind of fear that they faced if it wasn't acceptable to their boss, if you will. So if you put that on top of this, the changing testimony in Soviet hands among the two most important witnesses, and then you start widening the widening that circle beyond the two, because there were others who were also captured, Wilhelm Mohnke, for instance, and Hans Bauer, Hitler's personal pilot. You know, these individuals were caught by the Soviets and also interrogated. And the Soviets got so frustrated with their stories contradicting the stories of the two primary witnesses that, I mean, they did some pretty nasty things to some of these guys, as you might imagine. And it was mystifying to the, you know, to those who really didn't know the story. Why am I being kept here for 9 and 10 years and ask the same questions over and over and over again? Well, the bottom line is that the Soviets knew darn well that it wasn't adding up. And if anyone reads carefully the testimony as it grew, as the stories morphed in Soviet captivity, just that alone should, you know, raise a red flag, pun intended, right? On the other hand, these guys eventually were set free. Between 1952 and 1956, most of the bunker witnesses that the Soviets had in their possession were allowed to go home. And then what's interesting is, of course, everybody wanted to know, oh, does this match the story that we've been told? So they were endlessly blitzed with, you know, reporters and journalists and historians. And of course, there was a great deal of mystery. And from the get-go, for instance, Otto Gunsche or Heinz Linge or Hans Bauer, they were being asked by the Western, you know, media, what happened? And what you have again is now it's not just A through G morph, it's now G, H, I, J. It continues to change. Their testimony about what they supposedly saw continues to change. And they start then, I hate to call them liars, because those two individuals were definitely liars, but there's some of the other prisoners were lying because they just didn't know any better. But these two guys, they were allowed to collaborate, unfortunately, when they were in Soviet captivity and get their story straight.
So, Peter,
yes.
You know, one thing seems to me, if indeed Hitler was alive, that would be the other reason why they would continue this deception.
Indeed. Whether Gunsche or Linge knew that Hitler had survived, I'm not convinced. I do not have smoking gun evidence to say they knew for sure. And let me tell you why. Before they came back from Soviet captivity, the Soviet counterintelligence, they're not dummies. What they did is they would take people they had turned, who were also German POWs that may be known to Linge or Gunsche or Bauer or Mohnke or any other high-profile Nazi captives, and they would infiltrate their jail cell with these friendlies. And one of those friendlies was a...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The most important Wehrmacht brigadier general in World War II, and his name is Dr. Walter Schreiber. Dr. Walter Schreiber had discussions with all of these witnesses. You know what they told him? We don't know anything. Flat out. Mm-hmm. Linge, Lunsche, Bauer, they all admitted, we really don't know. Could Hitler be alive? It's possible. We didn't see anything. Not only do they admit that their story was a lie, they said they didn't see anything or have any part of it. So that's a real.
Well, that kind of makes sense in a way, because if he indeed was going to try to fake the suicide, it doesn't matter who that is. You don't want anybody to know besides him or whoever's going with him.
Correct. And my research indicates that the crew in charge of what I would not call it a suicide. I'd call it a pseudocide. The agent in charge was Sicherheitsdienst Heinrich Gestapo Müller. That's the guy in charge. He's the guy that got Hitler out. He's the guy that put on a fake death. And it was obviously very convincing to a lot of people. So I get back for a moment to the arrival of these key witnesses. In the mid-50s, they were called to testify in front of a Bavarian court. That Bavarian court had been established, get a load of this, to officially declare Hitler dead. Now, keep in mind that they called 43 witnesses, and the judge and the lead prosecuting attorney, the Germans didn't call him, that makes sense to an American audience. They interviewed all of these witnesses, and once again, all their stories were filled with inconsistencies, contradictions, outright lies, and they grow again. They grow by leaps and bounds in ways that are so embarrassing that to this day, the Bavarian state government will not publicly release those documents.
That's interesting.
It's just filled. It would be so embarrassing that this was a miscarriage of, it's a fraud. Alan, let me tell you flat out. The judge in charge of this case that proclaimed Hitler dead in 1956, he's a Nazi himself. And he was not only a Nazi, but he was the local federal judge in charge of Berchtesgaden, Hitler's own, Bavarian hometown close to the Berghof. And his right-hand man, get a load of this, the guy that did all the interviews and funneled all of the evidence through to make this conclusion that Hitler was indeed dead and could proclaim him dead, this fellow, he was second in command to Heinrich Gestapo Müller. Oh, gee, isn't that interesting? So we have two dyed-in-the-wool Nazis that are proclaiming Hitler officially dead. And we don't question that? I don't see how historians like Ian Kershaw, who was one of the few who has been given access to some of these documents, couldn't see through this. I mean, or even question it. It makes no sense to me. Anyway, but when you mess with the standard narrative, you have to unexplain a lot of things too, so maybe it was just too much.
So why do you think that the agencies nowadays don't go back and kind of do the research you're doing? And why aren't they investigating Hitler and stuff like that? Like, they don't seem to be that interested.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are people who are interested within those agencies, but I think as a general practice, this case has been put to rest for a long time in terms of an active investigation. People assume, for instance, that early on that America investigators, counterintelligence officers knew it was a slam dunk case. You know, we know Hitler was killed in the bunker. We know he committed suicide. That first premise is fundamentally flawed. That's the opposite of the truth. They didn't know what to do to begin with. There's no better person to talk about when it comes to that key first assessment than a fellow named Bill Heimlich. Heimlich was head of counterintelligence in Berlin. He conducted the first full-scale American investigation into the suicide story or Hitler's possible whereabouts. And after 6 months of investigation, he said flat out, this story makes no sense. It makes more sense that Hitler escaped. And you have to dig pretty deep to find all those other associated American intelligence officers who went down the same, trail. Because, I have to put this in context. This investigation is taking place in the summer of 1945 to begin with, and it continues into the fall of 1945. But the priority, and this is a long around way of answering your question, the priority between the politicians and the investigators didn't match. So, for instance, the priority among the politicians was, let's put together the ICC and preparation for the Nuremberg trials. Let's put together the framework for that and make some key decisions about that. And we'll let this investigation continue behind the scenes as it develops, but they were already making political decisions as a four-power pact, if you will, discussions. I think it was the London conference in the summer of 1945 where they made a decision. We are not going to prosecute Hitler in the Nuremberg trials in absentia like they did Bormann in absentia because it's just unsettled, and it's politically expedient just to act as if he's dead and proceed with the trial and not even raise that as a question, because there are more important things to do, like winning the peace, you see. So the short answer to the long story to your question is, it's about political priorities standing in the way of investigations or ignoring investigations or moving ahead with other more important things.
What was the biggest surprise? What was the biggest surprise when you were doing this?
Wow. The biggest surprise was the forensic evidence. You know, growing up, about like everybody else, I suppose, I was fascinated because I'm a history guy. Even as a kid, I was fascinated with reading all the stories and magazine articles and books that I could get my hands on, especially about the forensic details of Hitler's death. What really surprised me is how flimsy it turns out all of that was, too. And it's kind of sad looking back as a kid because, you have all these things that are imagined in your mind, and it turns out that, it's a good story, but there really isn't sufficient evidence to even say, for instance, that the dentition that the Soviets and now the Russians have been showing for decades is Hitler's. It is Hitler's, but it's not the correct set, for instance. Things like that are just, they were sad surprises, Sad surprises in the sense that, you don't want Hitler to have gotten away. And you're discovering that even some of the most widely assumed forensic stuff, everything from his blood type to DNA tests that were done, it all points in the opposite direction.
It's pretty amazing. So you said this, now this took you 10 years to go through and get this together?
Yeah, now keep in mind that when I say 10 years, 10 years of research. When you start out on a path like this, sometimes you don't even realize what path you're on. So 10 years ago puts me in, 2010 to 2011. And at that point, as any historian would do, I'm always gathering information. And at that point, like I mentioned, I was going after Girard to debunk what he had written and gathering information. And so, that's built over the years, and it's been a good 3 years of steady writing to finish the last book, Hitler's Suicide, Reasonable Doubt, at 661 pages and almost 1,300 annotated, footnotes. So it was a heck of a lot of work. I'm teaching a full day, and then I'm coming home, and I'm working 5 and 6 hours almost every day for almost 3 years. So it a lot of hard work.
The you said that, like, the forensics is off, and then let's say he did escape. You said that you did not focus anything on Argentina, but that's probably if he did indeed escape, that's likely the location that he would have gone to after Spain.
At least initially, it makes sense in terms of the politics to have gone there first. Of course, the politics changed in 1956, so you could imagine that might have changed all after 1956 as well. As Gerard Williams has pointed out in Grey Wolf, and a few other historians and journalists who have been barking up that tree for a while, they find some evidence of Hitler being in southern Brazil or perhaps in Paraguay or Uruguay. Again, I'm just going to say it flat out. I haven't done the due diligence to say one way or the other where he ended up ultimately and how long he stayed in point A or point B or point C.
Right. So I was just kind of curious, because here's an extreme narcissist megalomaniac that now has to hide the rest of his life. I was just curious, if I can't, it's hard to, anybody to put themselves in his shoes to see if that would be doable, that he would not attempt, let's say, a Napoleon thing, try to kind of come back. Is that maybe your next area of research, or are you going to stick with the first part because there's likely more material to find?
Alan, I must confess that my mind has not thought to that next level. Where I'm going to go next, I don't honestly know. I can tell you this much. What I've bitten off at this point is a heck of a lot to chew. So keeping your head wrapped around that material for an interview such as this, for instance, it's not an easy task. And so my mind has not gone elsewhere yet.
What do you hope people get? So they pick up the book, they read it, and they come away with what?
So I'm hoping that what they will do is just that that the weight of the evidence will open their mind to looking more carefully at what they've been told is the truth. And I'm not trying to say that they've been deceived on purpose. I can't speak to that issue. All I can say with 100% clarity is that it doesn't have to be a conspiracy for a person to believe that Hitler actually did not commit suicide in the Berlin bunker on April the 30th of 1945. The weight of the evidence and testimony does not substantiate that contention. So there are so few people who are, we start out talking about the different groups of people who are troubled by this. I hope to have dialogue with those people. Believe it or not, I respect these people. I was one of them myself in terms of being on their side. Like, for instance, you would ask me, like, who objects to it and why. One of my favorite groups that really objects strenuously to it, I would call them the Military Squad. Now, these are people who have mind-blowing amounts of information tucked away in their noggin about World War II weaponry. And they think that, you know, that their knowledge of the weaponry and subs and planes and all the rest has like transitive powers to prove that Hitler killed himself when they're not necessarily related. Now, that being said, I adore these people because they're an endless source of information for me. I respect these people because of the research they've done. And although I would argue with them, I would never return the vitriol that they've sent my way on a few occasions, if you know what I mean. And the same thing goes with those who are kind of like the biographers or the amateur psychologists that say, well, Hitler couldn't have done this because, you know, he ultimately was a suicidal personality or whatever, you know, simplistic sort of psycho babble you want to throw at this and explain this complicated mess with, you know, Hitler was just this because he was just mentally this. You know, just the people who are against any form of revision of history whatsoever. It's always entertaining to deal with them because I come from a background, actually, I studied as an archaeologist to begin with, and it's very perplexing. I really didn't expect the amount of objection that would come from this particular group. I would call them the anti-revisionists. Like, anything that you say that contradicts the standard narrative in any way, shape, or form is going to... they're going to get vulgar with you. They're going to put you down. They're going to... You know, it's just... It's kind of crazy. They'll treat you as if you're irrational. They'll call you all sorts of names. And conspiracy theorists, of course, is the favorite label they like to put on you. But ultimately... This book is written for them. It addresses all of their concerns straight up and in a way that I hope will convince them that this subject requires a deeper dive than it's been given in the past. And also, there's no one single place a person could go if they have questions to see all of the eyewitness testimony, to address all of the evidence that's been presented by, you know, various experts over the years in one place. So my second biggest intention in writing Hitler's Suicide Reasonable Doubt was to do that, was to write one book where all those things could be addressed at once and related to one another, and the reader could be guided through that process. And my writing style is just, it's just extremely transparent. I know it's annoying to some people because they don't like to hear what I think. But when I write, I tell the reader, here's the path I went down first, and I discovered this, and then it led me to that. And I then try to tie all that together with each and every witness and each and every piece of evidence. So, again, I'm becoming redundant here, but my ultimate intention is to reach out to anyone who's willing to listen and to convince those who are willing to talk about it. And I know there are some who are not even willing. They won't even discuss the topic because it's, for some reason, so offensive to them. But I think there's something for all of those different objectors in my book. And I think if they read it, I think if their mind wasn't changed, then they're showing their prejudice.
Peter.
No. Okay.
I have just a question on Eva Braun.
Yes.
Now, we know, what they have in history that he married her in the bunker, right? And so then committed suicide. So the question would be a person like this, would he have personally executed Eva Braun, or did she escape with him? If indeed he did leave, then is there a possibility of researching the descendants of Eva Braun or the family to see if she kind of maybe texted everybody in 1969? I don't know. But something to the effect that there might be an area of research with Eva Braun and what the family thought.
No, that's an excellent question. Eva Braun did escape with Hitler. There's no doubt in my mind about that. The marriage is, wow, talk about historical frauds. One of the most interesting things that I encountered was just dealing with the marriage document. If people don't like details, they shouldn't read my book, but I can tell you this. It's a fraud. Not only is it a fraud, but I think I've demonstrated 100% that it was a fraud perpetrated by Bormann with the intent to deceive, and that it was done long before April 29th, 1945, when it's supposedly dated. So, Eva Braun escaped with Hitler. The body, for instance, that the Soviets had, or claimed that they had, that was Eva Braun's, of course, they never took an autopsy photo, not a single one. Same thing with Hitler. There are no autopsy photos. They supposedly conducted this intricate autopsy, and they took this measurement and that measurement, which in my book I explain is actually impossible for them to have done. But in any case, even those people who were absolutely convinced by the forensic evidence that the Soviets were showing to the world and based their conclusions upon the forensic evidence of the Soviet autopsy, even those people, as time went on, became skeptical. I'll give you an example. One of the most brilliant forensic odontologists ever to live and breathe, Radar Sognes from Norway. He later was at the University of California, and he, for 10 years, looked into the dentition question and had access to the interrogations of Dr. Blotchke, who was Hitler's dentist, and Katte Hauserman, who was the dental technician, chairside technician, and Ekman, who was the creator of Hitler's, some of Hitler's dental work, and also some of Eva Braun's dental work. Even Sognes, although he proclaimed in 1973, for instance, that he was convinced that the teeth that the Russians say they have are Hitler's teeth because of, matching points, this, brilliant arguments on his part. But a mere 4 or 5 years later, he already was reassessing that because of what he found out about what they were saying about Eva. None of it matches. None of it makes any sense. And he said so. So, the way I like to take a look at some of the strongest arguments for dealing with that kind of forensic evidence with Eva had already been addressed in the late 70s to the mid 80s. Make a long story short, all of the leading forensic odontologists had concluded, like Dr. Lester Luntz, for instance, that no, that this does not match Eva Braun's teeth and jaw. What the Russians say they have, the Soviets say that, is not her, period. So, of course, this brings up the logical question. Well, this is the body that they found with Hitler, supposedly, right next to his, supposedly burned in the same condition. I suppose we could argue that, why would we believe that Hitler, that they had Hitler's actual teeth and jaw, if Eva's, they didn't really have Eva Braun's, and they discovered wounds in the Soviet autopsy. They even mentioned wounds to her body. They're a physical impossibility. And bleeding to her body, there's a physical impossibility for her, unless she was hit, for instance, by shrapnel prior to death. So the things that they describe in the autopsy are impossible. And I would argue that, getting back to the question of Hitler's autopsy, that what the Soviets claim they have is a complete lie, and purposely so. And the reason I believe this is because the Soviets, all they really had was a bag of bones. And I'm not kidding you. There are two very dependable witnesses who saw what the Soviets had with their own eyes. Only two. And one of them was a British intelligence officer who described these, what he saw in around June the 5th or 6th of 1945, what he was shown the Soviets had. And to make a long story short, the Soviets could not have performed an autopsy on what he saw with all the details that they're claiming. And keep in mind that the autopsy never came, did not come out until 1968. It was not presented to the public even until Lev Bezemensky's book in 1968, which detailed for the first time the, you know, secret documents from the Soviet archives, including the, you know, the autopsy documents. So another doctor who was of Romanian extraction, who was in Berlin at the time, he was asked to help to identify Hitler's remains, and he was led to three piles of human remains that were so badly burned, they were just essentially piles of charred ash. And so when you start comparing the stories of what that the Soviets actually had to what they're saying the autopsy, it doesn't add up in any way, shape, or form.
Pretty amazing story. So where do people get the book, and where do they find you? Do you have a website?
Yeah, peterdavidorr.com is the website. Just my full name, peterdavidorr.com. And my book is available on amazon.com.
Fantastic. We're going to have that linked up as well to our website, so people listening can do one click and find you and the book. So
excellent.
Great. We appreciate you coming on and talking about your new book. Our guest has been Peter David Orr, and the book is called Hitler's Suicide, Reasonable Doubt. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.